Wydawcą podcastu jest Polskie Wydawnictwo Muzyczne.
Hello, my name is Mariusz Gradowski and I am pleased to welcome you to the podcast, and it will be devoted to the Crass 52 Codex, a collection of musical manuscripts which dates back to the 15th century and which is just getting a new life. A new edition has been created, music from the Crass 52 sounds at concerts and is reaching an ever-widening audience. And I have invited two people to join the conversation. These are the people without whom this new life of Crass 52 would not be possible. It is my pleasure to welcome Agnieszka Budzińska-Bennett, vocalist, harpist, musicologist, founder and artistic director of Ensemble Peregrina, specializing in early medieval music performance. Hello, Agnieszka.
Hello to you.
And also with us is Mark Levon, lute player, musicologist, specialist in medieval music and professor at the Schola Cantorum Basiliensis. I'm not sure if this order suits you well. The lute first, Mark?
Yeah. I think you put it quite nicely. It depends. You know, we have many hats, and sometimes we are also, both of us, no, are ensemble directors, researchers, performers. It depends on the project at hand.
I see. Well, I just think that the music comes first, and when you just play it, it's like you are really there. Of course, you can study it, you can skip through manuscripts and do whatever it's needed to be done. But when you're on stage and when you are like dealing with music, that's the thing. Is it also true with you, Agnieszka?
Oh, we lead at least double lives, that's true. There is a part of us that works silently on our own very often, writing, researching, analyzing, and at some point comes more vivid moment of rehearsing and checking the results of our work. And then comes the very extrovert moment of being on stage.
Yes.
So it's all together at the same time, but of course we kind of switch between personalities, I can say.
I see. All right, so let's start the discussion with a basic question. I mean, really basic, but you know, you have to start from somewhere. What is Crass 52, Mark?
Well, I can tell you what Crass 52 is to me.
Right.
It is first and foremost a musical source of the 15th century, the earlier 15th century, one of those rarer cases of polyphonic music that we'll find in Central Europe, so that we have a coherent larger source, and in that it is unique. It is also, to some it might be, merely a source of concordances to other more famous manuscripts, but to me it is a very unique source that combines a repertory that was international at the time and combined with it a repertoire that is very local. So in that sense, a very, very unique and special source. And I love the unica. I love the unique pieces that are only found in this manuscript. And it always tickles my fancy when we can play something that has never either never been recorded before or that is only in this one source, and therefore something so very special.
Agnieszka, and Crass 52 for you, what is it in your eyes, in your ears actually?
And also to my mind. it's a source that I've known for such a long time since, of course, it's one of the subjects when you study musicology in Poland. It's, of course, one of the main medieval manuscripts that you come across, at least. I mean, we didn't do a profound study of it, but I've known about that. And actually, my very first CD was Crass 52. Which I've recorded many, many years ago, well, let's say 2 decades ago, still being a spring chicken in early music and not knowing so much I know today, obviously. But for me, it's, of course, everything what Mark said, but because of our multiple personalities and because of my nationality, this is a very patriotic look at this thing, because this is a symbol. This manuscript is of a great or greatest importance to Polish nation. It mentions first names of Polish composers. It is a symbol of a new dynasty. It's music written for court. The first time we have court music written for special occasions that are intrinsically connected to Krakow and the Krakow court and the Wawel Castle and the Jagiellonian dynasty. So this is something of a international importance and incredible national importance. I can clearly say, and without any exaggeration, it is a national treasure.
A national treasure. Mark, I think that sometimes we tend to overestimate certain cultural monuments from a local point of view. And I wonder what you think of Krasiński Codex in this particular stance. I mean, is it really that important as we tend to think as Poles?
It is very nice to be critical. Yeah, I find that it good to put things into perspective. And for me, in working with this manuscript, I have also come to see another perspective that Agnieszka just portrayed. Of how much national importance this manuscript is, because in the larger scheme of things, it is one of many manuscripts, certainly an important one, but probably not the most important source that we have for the music of this time. On the other hand, it does include those unique pieces which are from Krakow, which are from Poland, and which we otherwise would not have had if it were not for this one manuscript. So I can see both sides, and for me, it's interesting to see the Polish point of view here. As someone who is interested in music of the late 14th, early 15th century, it is a manuscript of interest to me, certainly. But seeing how important it is for the history of music in Poland, I do understand its unique status.
Speaking about criticism, after having said what I said in a patriotic manner, I also can add that I don't think that some pieces in this manuscript are well written. We have very different layers of quality pieces there. Still, even those that are not handsomely written, they're still of great importance. So I think we can layer this this division and this views on the manuscript. So it's important, but it's not necessarily containing all perfectly and beautifully written pieces. There's some struggle of composers or scribes. So it's very interesting. Just to add this, that I'm not partial.
And I absolutely agree with what Agnieszka just said. And I must say that our view, when we started looking more closely at the manuscript, was that there were pieces where we kind of rolled our eyes a bit in the beginning, or looking at the counterpoint, I was going, you know, it's not the best written piece, you know, some of them. But in the process of actually working with the music, I think a number of these pieces have really grown on us. And they revealed qualities in performance that we didn't really see on the paper before. So just merely looking at the counterpoint, we thought, And then actually doing it, we thought, this is actually a good piece, you know. So it's interesting how practice can add to our understanding of what is written on the page.
All right, so let's dig Crass 52. Let's take a closer look. What do we find in this manuscript? What music? What composers? What styles?
A whole variety of styles. As Mark mentioned before, we have imported pieces, so pieces also from late 14th century, pieces that have already a long tradition, and composers that are known in whole Europe. We have great names in this manuscript. We have Johannes Ciconia, we have Zacharia da Teramo, we have Grossin, we have French composers, we have northern composers that work in Italy. So we have like the whole Europe came to Krakow and just got some space in this manuscript, meaning that apparently Krakow at that time would have known this music. This music would have been hopefully played and would have been appreciated and would have been kind of something to copy, something to learn from, because really like up-to-date music, the new music was imported and was there. So this is like one level we can think about. And then we have again the local stuff that it's a bit more modest in terms of counterpoint, or has some novelties that can stem from new ideas or not very solid knowledge. It's always difficult to say. We had the same discussion when we did the big project of Mikołaj Gomułka, recording of all the songs. This is a Renaissance music, and sometimes there's a classical setting that we understand, and there is all of a sudden a piece that we used to call it between ourselves, it has a local or Eastern flavor, because we don't know if there was a composer not knowledgeable about some kind of counterpoint that is kind of excluded theoretically, or if that's a scribe or print setter, or, you know, so looking for solutions for this problem. We have different genres. We have sacred music, we have secular music, we have mass movements, we have pieces that were apparently must have been used in the liturgy, but we do not know where. So like kind of motets or canciones. And then we have court music, which is again very different. We have mostly three-part pieces, but there are two written as a two-part, to which we also could propose a little bit of a third voice, because this is like a very standard procedure. And diversity of texts, different forms, different idea of what text is, different destination or different recipient. So we were working all those levels, stylistically, musically, and literary levels or registers. It was incredible to write essays about this manuscript, because like each of our essays is very different because the pieces differ quite a lot.
Mark, I would like to ask you about one thing. Agnieszka mentioned that those compositions of Polish composers were quite difficult to understand. Was it a mistake, or was it done on purpose, this particular sound between sounds? Do you think that we can trace the way of learning of Polish composers, studying how they studied Western music? Or maybe this is the source that could be, I don't know, an evidence of the local musical tradition?
Yeah, I think you're hitting the nail on the head here. I think it's a mixture of both. There surely are local traditions, also forms of improvised polyphony that have a local flavor, which made its way into the pieces. And it is sometimes difficult to discern what is intended and what might be a mistake. I'm not necessarily a mistake by the composer, but a mistake by the scribe. Yeah, we do have lots of scribal mistakes from copying the music. And our problem is with the lack of concordances, we cannot compare with other sources to see, oh, if the mistake happened here by writing it down, or if this was actually an intended flavor to the composition. And we do have humbler pieces, so more humble compositions that are not supposed to be a huge construction of counterpoint, but a piece that would be delivered quite effectively, maybe in the liturgy or at court. And we have other compositions by the local composers, which, let's say, are more ambitious. Some of them clearly try to emulate the kind of counterpoint that we see in Johannes Ciconia's greater pieces, mass movements or motets. And we see how certain motifs travel from Ciconia and from the Italian composers into these new compositions. And I would say some are more successful in emulating that. Others are maybe also an attempt. We can never know if a piece was a work in progress, something to try out and see, or if it was meant to be exactly that and intended as a finalized product, an accomplished product. Some of these are actually quite hard to perform. No? Agnieszka, I remember, I think some of these more ambitious local productions were hard to sing and perform. So they require a lot of skill. These guys must have been good.
What was difficult in singing those pieces, Agnieszka?
There are some pieces by Mikołaj Radomski, who is our main 15th century composer, and he's also called like the first known composer before Chopin. Like, you know, so some musicologists were trying to elevate him even further. But yeah, he wrote some mass movements, three-part mass movements that have a touch of Ars Subtilia, which is like most... Yeah, one of the most difficult musical styles to perform because of very complex rhythmic layer, and also some intervals that are, or some sounds that are supposed to be dissonant. They resolve, but maybe not the way expected. So this piece was very misleading, and they are a bit longish pieces. So one tires basically as a singer, having to deal with very, very dense texture and lots of traps on the way. So these are One Gloria and Credo were really tough to record. But I think the result is very much okay. And I think the listener will be also fascinated with this crazy texture. And one can hear that there is a great deal of knowledge and a very bold attempt to produce really complicated mass movements. The question is who could have received that, because this is like really very special on the landscape of Polish compositions. So the composer was very bold.
As you mentioned before, this is not an unknown source. In the 70s, it was developed and published by an outstanding Polish musicologist, the late Professor Mirosław Pesz, who sadly passed away in March 2023. So what were the reasons for preparing a new edition of Kras 52?
Well, the monumental edition by Pesz was a scholarly edition, very, very well made and very thorough. Everything was marked and it was very cleanly transcribed. So it made the source available to scholarship and also to performers. Performers also went to that scholarly edition to perform certain pieces from there. But the edition was not prepared as a performance edition, and also didn't solve some of the problems that the notation contains. Some of the problems Pesz found a solution for, so small scale problems in counterpoint or where something was missing, he made suggestions that are very sensible also, but he did not dare to go deep into the counterpoint, make stronger emendations, and for good reasons, of course. You know, this was to put forward to scholarship a source as closely as it is in the original. However, since that time, we've learned a lot about the music and also musical practices of the late 14th and early 15th centuries. And so we can make some bolder suggestions in amending or correcting counterpoint, and also to make a musical edition that can be performed, that is made for performers, that they can play from this, where we suggest complete solutions. This includes pieces that are fragmentary. And in the first edition, of course, those fragmentary pieces remain fragmentary. Of course, the scholarly edition can only show what's there and not suggest a completed piece, meaning that we'd reconstruct or recompose certain sections. Our edition, however, went that far, and there was a demand for completing incomplete pieces, which meant that I, in some cases, basically recomposed a voice. In other cases, certain counterpoint is implied. When two voices move in certain parallel intervals, there is a suggestion that this third voice can join in. And such a voice was usually extemporized, so improvised. And of course, we cannot expect from modern performers to have all this knowledge at hand. So we're suggesting this third voice that might be implied. In another case, research from later decades has placed a piece in context with other pieces. So all of a sudden, we can look at other surviving pieces and take information or contrapuntal information from there and use that to complete a piece that is incomplete in Kras 52. I've done that also, and we've worked together in finding those exemplars.
Oh, yes, that's what I was going to ask, because you worked together on this edition, and I'm curious, how did you divide your duties? Who was responsible for what?
That was very simple, because Mark is a master of notation of that period, and I'm very feeble-minded with musical notation, so that was his task. And I think I'm not bad with literary stuff and analysis of poetry. And so I wrote most of the essays about the content and the context of pieces, because this is also, I think, my strong suit and something that interests me most. And Mark was like a technician here, so to say, and also someone who wrote parts of the essays explaining the complexity of notation and what he did exactly, how he reconstructed or recomposed some parts of the manuscript, and also, how can I say, illuminated us what procedures are possible, why he chose this way, and it's really beautifully founded description of what he's done in order to recreate the music that we now can perform. And these are what we're talking now are 7 or 8 pieces that all of a sudden can resound for the really very first time. When you, Mariusz, mentioned the Professor Pesz edition, it's been 50 years. So Mark also mentioned so much has been done, but also we have so many more concordances. So we can, from this context, again, we can know more about foreign pieces in this manuscript and about performance practice, exactly. And 50 years ago, the musicologists had no chance to hear this music performed in an informed way because there was too little information. There were, of course, trials. We're very fond of all the pioneers of early music performance, but it was just simply lacking knowledge and access to treatises, to other sources. Now we're in a very fortunate situation that so much is digitalized, so we can quickly jump to another source and compare. And this makes this work, or this edition, of course, in a sense, complete and very up to date, because now we have like everything we know in that very moment, we have in this edition. And the essays, just to mention that, this is something that's a little bit missing in Pesh edition, because again, it was a huge volume which contains not only Kras, because it brought forth other sources, fragmentary or not. So it's a huge work. There's also a volume with facsimiles. At that time, of course, black and white, so this is nothing we can work with anymore. But at that time, it was absolutely crucial. But there is a very, very tiny bit of commentaries. The concordances mentioned, known at the time, and text printed, but there's very little comment on what it is. Like genres, exactly, or like cross-genres, or like the story of the pieces is not there. And that was something that I thought we really have to provide the reader and the musician nowadays, just to enable them to understand more. And that was a great joy for me to write those.
I learned a lot. I learned a lot from those essays. And I'm curious, is there any puzzle that Professor Pesch couldn't solve and you solved it somehow?
Hard to say. He didn't really point out where he is despairing and what doesn't work or so. It's more a matter-of-fact working process that he probably followed, showing what's there, trying to put the counterpoint together as it seems fit, and publishing that as is. While what we are doing now is a much more of a process, and I believe in the articles that we provide with each of the pieces, we are trying to give the reader an idea of our process, to talk them through the difficulties that we've encountered and to talk them through the solution that we found. And I believe that is important to impart on the reader, because only then can the music be understood on its own terms. The musical text, as it is on the page, it doesn't exist in a vacuum, so to speak. It's not an absolute work. It is a piece of work that works only in a context, in a certain context. And we're trying to provide that context for the reader to better understand how the music functions, how it could possibly be performed in a sensible way so that it makes sense. And a musical life beyond that manuscript that is usually not written down, or that is done by rote, by heart, or by extemporizing, by improvising, and that didn't make its way into the codex, but which was there. So yeah, that to us is interesting also, I believe, the musical life, to see the seat of this kind of music and what is next to it in the musical life of the time, the soundscape of a city.
Soundscape of a city, yeah, that it gives me goosebumps, because I try to imagine those people who are singing those songs, or those people who are listening to those musical pieces. Speaking of listening, the new edition of Kras 52 is performer-friendly, I would say. And you prove it. You both prove it, that it's easy to take those pieces and perform them live. Tell me about concert life of Kras 52.
I prepared the performance editions, so we had to go one step further than to make them suitable to exactly our ensemble combinations with transpositions and everything. But Agnieszka put together the programs.
Yeah, as usual in my life, I'm trying to provide consistent and concise programs that make sense thematically, that we can just maybe illuminate one or two aspects of something. So we had a Marian program. There is a bulk of Marian pieces in Kras, which of course also shows the importance of Virgin Mary already very early on for Poland. And we had another program that was trying to show the Swiss public, because we had 8 concerts in Switzerland, showing the court music of Krakow. So something they could maybe imagine. For me, it was really interesting to present this program to Swiss public. Switzerland does not know royalty. Talking about a new dynasty and the glory of the Jagiellonians was, of course, quite shocking to probably to Swiss public. And the existence of court music is, well, I cannot say foreign to that, because we do have kind of aristocracy in Switzerland, but not the royals. So I think that was an interesting aspect. And Krakow is, of course, something any public all over the world can associate with something, with buildings, with culture, maybe with some history. We tried to deliver, again, the context, and we did moderate most of the concerts. So we helped the Swiss public to dive in a little bit in this still foreign, in any sense, foreign music. And also 15th century is not the first concert material that a normal mortal listener wherever goes to. So it just needs a little bit of help. So we tried to introduce something and to lead them through the concert. And I was trying to provide some information on medieval Poland.
I find it really interesting how well these programs worked. One could think, you know, we're taking music only from one codex, much of which is sacred music or functional music, if we have mass sections and all that. But it was amazing to see how diverse the musical program within the manuscript is, so that you can put together nice concert programs that work for today's audiences as well, with many different textures, some more simple and more hum-along, you could say, others really complex pieces of work that you can enjoy also intellectually, and employing a number of different instruments as well. I must say that I also did a course at the Schola Cantorum, an ensemble class on this codex. And the students, after having, you know, they need to get to know the repertoire for a while, and they kind of found their way with it, performed a very nice concert at the end of that ensemble class in Basel as part of their work, their ensemble work at the Schola Cantorum. And a few of them we could also take to an excursion. We had a concert in Morocco where we performed Krasinski Codex under palm trees.
So,
and that
work?
Worked also. Of course, the context is completely different. Here in Switzerland, we were performing in churches. I think all of the concerts really were in a church context, and the music fits that space very well, of course. In Morocco, it was an open-air festival. It was musique sacrée, so it was sacred music that was performed of the world, but it was an open-air stage next to a lake where the frogs were making their noises during the concert. And of course, we were amplified. We all each had microphones, but it was very sensibly done with some acoustics put on so that the audience gets an aural impression of a bigger space, like a church space or something like that. And we had some interviews before, and we had interviewers coming to our tables where we sat before. And the students are so eager to perform and do the stuff, they just spontaneously sang some four voice pieces from the codex into the microphones of the journalists that were beleaguering them. It was beautiful. It was so alien. There was such a contrast in environment. But it was very well received because the harmonies are so sweet. And I think they transgress these spaces. It works. It just works.
Wonderful.
As music.
I think we're great ambassadors of that manuscript. Now you brought it to Northern Africa.
Absolutely. Who'd have thought? Who'd have thought?
Yeah, in the beginning of this year, we could, in March or February, I don't remember, we were in Vilnius. So we could also bring Kras to do some brothers in crime to Lithuanian public. There was also absolutely thrilled by the music, and we performed in the palace of the princess in Vilnius. So I think we're like an octopus, and I hope that we can reach more and more countries and show this music with Ensemble Dragma, which is the main ensemble performing this music and the main ensemble that recorded it. It's the CDs are featuring Peregrina a little bit, because it's just it's not possible not to mention Peregrina, because I had my singers from Peregrina doing vocal stuff, because that was a guarantee for me. I think we're lucky we have these 8 concerts we've done. We were only 5 people, but we are multi, again, not personalities, but also multi-workers. So each of us, almost each of us, sings and plays instruments. So with 5 people, we could cover 3 voices, several fiddles, 3 or 4, I even don't remember, Mark's lute, Mark's guitar, and 2 different harps. So it's quite rich. We load it with instruments. And I think we just, of course, went for looking for colors and instrumentation that suits the pieces and emphasizes the beauty best we can imagine with our experience and ears. We hope to have performance with a bigger ensemble, also with lots of male voices. But this is also always a financial question of a festival and logistic stuff. But this 5 people and 8 concerts, I think that was a great success, and we really enjoy them.
I think we reached to the point where we can go personal. I mean, scholars aside, and please tell me, what's your dearest piece from Crass 52? Mark.
Oh, I go first. That's difficult.
Yes.
Yeah, I've spent so much time with each of these pieces, editing them and sometimes, you know, trying to solve the riddles. To say that I have a favorite one is really difficult. I very much like the Chicconias and Zakara piece, of course, the international repertoire, that's pretty obvious. But I must say, a little dear friend of mine became Nitor, you know, this piece where only the Discanto's voice survives, or should we say Motetto's voice, because the assumption is that this was actually meant as a motet with 2 lower voices, where Reinhard Strom had found a cognate version that survives, and where I was then able to take the lower voices of that cognate motet that survives with all 3 voices to start a new counterpoint for this lonesome upper line, and then to freely finish composing that. And that kind of grew on me. At first, it was a tedious task because you have this upper voice and you're like, I could compose anything below that that would sound sort of 15th century-like, but I want to be, I need more to really justify printing a new counterpoint that isn't there. But Agnieszka found this article by Reinhard Strom, or this mention, where he likens that piece to Apollini's Eclipsator, a very famous motet from that same time, which has almost identical beginning in the motetto's voice. And all of a sudden, you have something, you have a model to latch on to compose something new. I thought, okay, it's not random, but it is, you know, you could compose anything, but all of a sudden I had something to hold on to, and bit by bit that piece grew on me. And we have 2 different texts in Krasinski Codex, so that we can even justify doing it twice or in 2 different versions. And I really enjoyed that one, I must say. Enjoyed playing it, enjoyed listening to it.
I do agree, because I wanted to mention this one. I had an honor to sing one of the versions, and it's also an important piece, and I'm so happy that we brought it back to life, because exactly, yeah, would have been silent forever. And it's important also because one of the versions is exactly one of the pieces for the birth of Prince Władysław Warneńczyk, which is a jubilee year, because this is 24 is the year of his birth. But 2 other pieces I liked very much are the reconstructions, completely unknown, and pieces that people haven't heard yet. One is Karomea, which is a fragmentary piece that is missing 2 voices again. It has just 2 upper parts, but it has a complete text at least, so if you have 2 upper parts, it's already a bit easier to write the rest, basically. And Mark reconstructed this beautifully and with greatest respect to textures and counterpoint. And another one, there is actually our, since we're getting personal, it's our baby, Mark, who is Ave Sancta Humanitas, where Mark reconstructed the beginning of the piece. It starts like on a page somewhere in the middle or wherever, and I reconstructed the text. So
I agree. I love that one by now. As when we practiced it, when we rehearsed it, I go, what an intense texture. And at first you think, oh yeah, it's this piece where the beginning is missing and I don't know, what can we make out of this? And all of a sudden it's one of our faves.
Exactly. Sorry. So the unknown ones, of course, I think we all love Magnificat by Radomski, but I am a little bit saturated with that since I've performed it so many times. And there are some pieces that are performed often by different ensembles. And yeah, maybe I'm looking for some new flavors. So that's why the unknown, basically, and reconstructed pieces. But we hope that people will appreciate these exactly, not going, you know, like there's concert life where you have just the works of Mikołaj of Radom. We won't understand them without having these pieces we're mentioning now in the under the context of that. Exactly, in our concerts also, I tried to maybe place new pieces, you know, like contextualize it within the manuscript and then within other manuscripts, just to show what they are, because we need context. We cannot even enjoy one or two pieces if we don't know the rest. I mean, we can, of course, but we will enjoy and appreciate it much more if we know what was possible at the time and what was grand at the time. And yeah, so we're coming again to this levels of compositions, but I think we did elevate, and honestly, with honest joy, we elevated some of the rare pieces and less known or not yet existing in performance, the pieces that haven't been performed yet, ever.
And of course, we've left our mark on this repertoire now with the edition and with the recording. So it's also, of course, the way I wrote some of the voices reflects my taste to a certain degree. I mean, I'm observing the rules of counterpoint of the time, but there's always something of yourself that you put in there, especially if you're working creatively. So, yeah, you know, it also contains the edition and the recordings contain some of our experience, of our tastes as well. But again, in the edition, we've made sure that all new decisions are carefully marked. That means everything that has been changed in the notation or corrected, amended, or inserted is marked as such, and what it says in the original is in the margin. So if someone does not agree with a certain correction and wants to retain the original, let's say, dissonance, which can also be nice and maybe even intended, you know, sometimes one can go overboard with corrections. I've tried to restrain myself, but sometimes, you know, you can take a different decision, absolutely. So the original pitches are always notated directly in the margin, so you can immediately change that back if you so wish. You don't have to search in the appendix somewhere to find what the original actually said. So nothing is done silently, but you know, it's all very clear.
Well, let's take an example, the very known Breve Regnum. Until today, nobody knows what form it is. We offered one transcription and we commented on that in an essay, but we recorded two different forms just to show, you know, make a pick. It can be done like this, it can be done like this, but maybe somebody has another idea. So we left lots of choices. And
yeah, there's a certain openness to the text, you know, that's inherent, of course, to medieval manuscripts in any case. So sometimes we couldn't be sure what, let's say, the correct or the way was that it was originally intended. So we are sometimes suggesting this or the other option. And in other cases, it could also be an open interpretation. So it could have been plausibly done in different ways back then also. So we are trying to show the openness of the text, and meaning musical text and, of course, textual text, text and music text.
And so, you know, we open so many doors, I think, and we hope that listeners and readers will understand that there are so many more possibilities. As Mark said, it's just a part of medieval music. This degree of freedom is always individually to be chosen, because we have philology, we have rules, we have this and this, and there's lots of a gray zone in between. So an addition is, of course, very difficult, because you make a decision, but it cannot be seen as something iron and unchangeable. So I think that was the message also in this several cases we tried to send to the world and our readers.
Agnieszka, Mark, we could talk about Crass 52 for ages, actually. But unfortunately, our podcast time is running out, and we have to go to our finales, our end note. And what's your message to the world with Crass 52?
Maybe I'd say we were just very lucky to have this interdisciplinary project, because it is a luxury to be able to create an edition the way we've just described it, and to then to record the complete manuscript and also to have concerts with this. So I think the message is like the more people you involve that are knowledgeable and competent, and the more different aspects you bring to that in interdisciplinary way, I think this is the best way for projects like this, because as Mark mentioned before, our performance reinformed the edition, and it's a constant dialogue, and our rehearsals and concerts did influence to a great deal the edition. So I think basically it's the only right way to do this. This dialogue of mind and voice and instruments and knowledge, and I think it will raise lots of discussions, we hope, and will just enable so many people to come to appreciate this music, this manuscript, this recording, this style, and to learn a little bit more about Polish 15th century.
Beautifully said, Agnieszka. Couldn't really add anything to that. I must say that this again showed that when you're going into the foxhole of one style or one manuscript, you'll find your paths that lead to ever more exciting discoveries, I think. And you engage with a repertoire in a very different way when you are confronted with a project like this, with so many disciplines. And it was wonderful to also work with Agnieszka, who has this other view from the textual and the contextual side, while I was kind of with a tunnel vision looking at the counterpoint and at the notation. It's great to bring these two realms together, and a project like this made that possible, together with a great publisher who created a wonderful typeface for a beautiful looking edition as well. It is not just like my notation program, but it is something that jumps off the page and shows how precious this music is. I mean, the way it is printed, I think, elevates the music or so. Also, we could go some new paths with printing red notation in red in the edition, so to give the reader a more immediate clue of what the original looks like, and maybe trigger also sensitivities towards what colored notation means in the manuscript. You do not necessarily need the color in the edition to read. You can make a black and white copy of a page and still perform the music correctly, but the coloration from the original will help to better understand the music. And I think we are actually treading some new paths here. And maybe incite others to do editions in a similar way, especially performance editions.
Well, this is what I wish you and myself. Thank you for all your work, for all your input, for all your hours that you have spent on this manuscript. And our guests on our podcast were Agnieszka Budzińska-Bennett. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Mark Levon. Mark, thank you.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
It was a pleasure for us, and it will be when we will get to listen to recordings that are made and when we will be able to hold our copies of the new edition.
A heavy one.
A heavy one, yes. But it's worth it. It's worth it. Okay.
Sure.
So, till our next meeting. Goodbye. Mariusz Gradowski.
Wydawcą podcastu jest Polskie Wydawnictwo Muzyczne. Zapraszamy na kolejne odcinki oraz do śledzenia naszych mediów społecznościowych.